Good evening. This is Ray Hill. You're listening to radio station KPFT Houston via the internet. Normally, this would be on HD Channel 2. This is Execution Watch, produced by Elizabeth Stein. With me in the studio is
for greed. Europe
Jim
says
Skelton.
The cash crisis shouldn't choke emissions
that
targets.
You will hear
with more evidence
on the show
of the economic downturn today, what's left for stockbrokers to do?
But right now we're going to go to Huntsville, Texas, with Professor Longmire. Professor, are you there?
Okay. I can bear it. There's a full version of that.
I am fine. I'm not getting you in my headphones.
Coming up.
So.
And we'll hear from the place currently coining it in, one of the world's major
myths. It's all
coming up here on The World Today.
Can you hear me now?
I cannot hear you on my headphones yet. So we got some technical problems here.
But the headphone wires, the bottom. Okay.
This one? All right. That's good. I hear you. I hear it. Speak
again.
Can
you hear me? Can you hear me now?
You're on now. So
okay. As we speak, the witnesses are walking in for Kevin. The media witnesses went in at 6:59, and then just as you called, his witnesses started crossing the street, so they have just entered the main building of the walls unit. And so it is clear from us here at the corner that the execution is going forward as planned and with no pause, no hesitation whatsoever.
His witnesses, family and friends, how many of them were there?
I think I saw about six people that were not in uniforms, and so it looked like there might have been five or six of them. I did not recognize any of them, but I am not familiar at all with the family or the case, but there were about five, maybe six of them who went in.
Is there any local media there?
There is no media, local or otherwise. No media at all. In fact, there are four of us on the corner who are clearly here in opposition, four regulars.
Mm-hmm.
Three people who are standing, and they, one of them I know is attending a training program at the Criminal Justice Center, and so they're all collected together. My guess is that they're all here more as what I call accidental tourists than anything else. And so it's a quiet night and a cold night on the corner.
Yeah, the weather is cooler up there than it is here.
Yes, it's cool and kind of hazy. There's almost a fog in the air.
At the walls. Okay, Professor Longmire, we're going to go back to the studio, and Jim and I are going to be conversing on some things for a while. If anything happens, you have Elizabeth's cell phone number. You can call her, and she'll call you right back on the live line for the
broadcast. Okay, very good.
Thank you very much, sir.
Sure thing.
And we'll talk to Professor Longmire at a little more length whenever he... when we get him back on. Jim, what's going on here? Well, tell me about this case.
Well, this is one of the more unusual cases in the sense it's really on what you call extremely fast track. What happened in this case, Kevin Watts went into a Korean restaurant in San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
And the name of the restaurant was the San Juan Gardens or Samsung Gardens or San Juan Gardens. And there were four people inside the restaurant. He demanded money. And Koreans aren't very good about giving up money without a fight. And they wouldn't even give him the money. And it made him angry. And he took them all to the back room of the kitchen, had three of them kneel down, the man who owned the restaurant plus two employees, and shot all three of them in the back of the head.
Mm-hmm.
Then after he killed them, he abducted and kidnapped the wife of the man who owned the restaurant. She'd been in this country about 2 months. He grabs her and runs out to the parking lot and throws her inside of her car, their car, the car that she and her husband had, and drove off. As they're driving off, a guy named Jesse Rios, who does some deliveries to the restaurant, drives up, and he sees the car driving off in a rush and sees a black man hauling off the manager's wife. So he goes back in the kitchen, discovers the three bodies. Two of them are dead. One of them dies later at a hospital. So he notifies the family. They get the license plate description of the car, and then they put out an all people. In fact, they did it on radio plus on the police radio. And what happened after this guy, Watts, abducts the wife, they drive around for a while. Then he ends up taking her over to an apartment complex in San Antonio where his maternal grandmother lived.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes inside the apartment complex, parks the car, and so, because there was so much publicity, it was three people shot and killed. Somebody who heard the radio broadcast saw the car outside the apartment complex. So they notified the police. The police surround the car, and they surround the apartment complex, and lo and behold, out comes Watson, dragging the woman with him. Jumps in the car, and they tried to stop him. He rams the police car, and there's a brief scuffle. He finally gets out of the car, and he's carrying around his neck on a sling one of these Tech 9 guns. I'm sure you've probably seen them. That's kind of, you always seen Scarface, and it's kind of like a baby machine gun.
Mm.
And he shoots 22s, but it's like a Tech 9 is one of the drug dealers use a lot of Tech 9s. They're kind of a poor man's Uzi.
Mm-hmm.
And so he gets out of the car, and he has the gun with him. Of course, there's no shooting there. They abduct and they catch him then, and then the woman gets out, screams. She identifies him as being the man who was assailant, and then they discover that what he had done after the killing, he had raped the manager, the lady who just recently became a widow, and then he was at a guy's house, and the guy's house is Terrence Bolden at his apartment, and after he got through raping her, Terrence Bolden raped her. So she got raped twice after seeing. In fact, as a matter of fact, he ordered her to take the billfold and money out of her dead husband's pants.
And she had only been in the country a few.
2 months, about 2 months. And so what happened, then he confesses. And so it's one of those cases that there's literally nothing. And this is one of these lawyer nightmares because not only that, of course, all the ballistics match up. He has the gun around his neck that's a murder weapon. He has the victim, one of the victims with him. He confesses to the crime, and it's one of those. There's just no question. And here's what's strange. And I don't know whether this is lack of lawyer control or lack of client control, because every lawyer should know this. And I'm sure these lawyers in San Antonio knew it. During the time he was in jail, he was involved in numerous fights. He created a lot of activity in jail, wrote letters to a prospective gang called the Black Gorillas about joining it, knowing in advance. You know, the jailers read that stuff. And, I mean, he did himself no favors while he was in jail. And then during the trial, and at least it's some articles, newspaper articles I read, his family were hassling the dead people's, the victim's family during the case, during the trial. I mean, he talked, and this guy has a death wish. I mean, that's insane. Because you normally don't have hassling the family of the victims during a trial unless you're just really totally. In fact, the last time they did that in Houston.
Well, he was only 21 years old when this crime happened. He's 27 now.
But his family were the ones hassling the family of the dead people. You know, the last time this happened, you may remember Leotis Johnson years
sure.
ago? The reason he got so much time, because the courtroom was filled up with a lot of guys who were hooting and hollering. The jury got furious at these idiots with big afros yelling at the jury, daring them to do things, and they did it. No, they did exactly what they did. And so they promptly convict him, and there's no question about his guilt, ever. And so they do a punishment hearing, and in that punishment hearing, they prove up a lot of his, he had priors for virtually everything. He's also pretty high on drugs. He'd been using a lot of drugs. In fact, even his family members talked about having a drug problem, what a problem he was. He'd been a problem even as a juvenile. But there was nothing in the records to indicate that he came from any type of impoverished childhood or childhood like the Penry family where he was beat or abused. There's nothing to indicate that. And what they did at the punishment hearing, they simply introduced evidence of his prior membership in gangs, his desire to be a member of this Black Gorilla activist group. Plus, now this is really smart, he writes a letter wanting to kill Hispanics and white folks. This is on the jury. Right. Hispanic and white folks. And you know, guess what happens when that happens? You know, and why don't you just say, now lay me down to sleep? You know, they're going to cancel Christmas because they're going to kill him in 2 seconds.
Well, one of the reports that I read, he was somewhat disappointed that he's on death row with people that have been there 15, 20, 25 years. And here it is 6 years later after his crime, and he's belly up to the bar.
Well, the only reason is 6 years, they did a moratorium, or it had been quicker.
They did a several-month moratorium yeah. about the injection.
Because, you know, I've read a lot of these cases, and I have never, ever seen a case that had so little written. I mean, so usually kill a couple of trees on a death penalty case, on doing briefs
sure.
and stuff. The opinion that affirmed it, let me explain how this works. When they write an opinion from a court, there's two types of opinions, published and unpublished. When it's unpublished, that means there's nothing in the opinion of merit that we need to worry about. Every opinion out of the state court written on this case was unpublished, which means there was nothing novel, unique, or new about the arguments made.
In terms of the process of execution.
That's right. And then the next thing, there's a thing called a per curiam opinion. What per curiam basically means is the nickname for it, supermajority. They're just, in fact, usually it's written by a staff member, not a judge. Most per curiam opinions are written by a staff as opposed to a judge. All of his opinions on direct appeal that affirmed it, per curiam, one-page opinion. The post-conviction writ, per curiam, in fact, it was only three paragraphs. And I don't know whether this was showing contempt or what, but normally when you have a post-conviction writ, at least they will tell you what issues the guy brought up. They didn't even bother to do that. They just simply said, we reviewed the trial court's finding, and he's right. Let's kill him. I mean, that was the craziest thing I've ever read.
Now, that's Texas Court of Criminal Appeals.
That's right. Same thing with federal court. Federal court didn't give much more time because what happened in federal court, as you well know, after you do your state writ, you go direct appeal. If that doesn't work, then you go a post-conviction writ in state court. If that doesn't work, then what you can also do, I should mention, after your direct appeal, you can apply for certiorari to the U.S. Supreme Court. Didn't do it in this case. Then they file a federal writ, and they don't even... when you read the federal writ, the district court didn't even bother to write a written opinion about it. They just simply denied it, all of its grounds. And then they wouldn't give him what's called a certificate of appealability, because to appeal in federal court, to go to the Court of Appeals, Fifth Circuit, New Orleans, you've got to get the trial court to certify there's some question that's worthy of appeal. They wouldn't grant him a certificate of appealability. So he appeals to the Fifth Circuit, and they say, you're right, you don't deserve one. And they did that, and then the Supreme Court denied certiorari, and that's
the end of it.
It's kind of like that. There's a great line in country music, they laughed at me, and then I shot them. He killed the Cora Wrens, and they're going to kill him, and ain't nobody going to stop it. I'm telling you, no one.
Well, I mean, you say that this is unusual.
As a general rule, you're going to have some sort of issue at trial that's hotly contested. Here, guilt is not contested.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, in most death penalty cases, you're going to have something at punishment, like what we call a penury issue, where somebody's been abused or neglected or hurt, and the crazy word they use, he's not death worthy, whatever that's supposed to mean. I mean, we have these macabre things we say. And in this case, there were no issues at punishment to speak of. In fact, the only three things brought up on direct appeal was they argued that the trial court erred by putting in membership of his gang membership, which is admissible. Because one of the questions, future danger, if you're going to join a gang that's going to dictate you ain't going to be exactly a member of the Rotary Club. And then they had an issue about proportionality, that they thought the death penalty was not appropriate for what you did. Well, in this case, it's 3-for-1, so maybe it's more. He killed three and they killed one of him, so it's kind of hard to make that argument. And then the third thing, they argued that it was cruel and unusual, which has been...
Well, is this you know, just this case, or are we going to be seeing more of this under the effective execution laws?
I think it's just this case. Because, and you think about, if you're a lawyer, what would you do if someone came to you with this set of facts? You're caught within hours of the killing with a murder weapon strapped around your neck. You have just raped the widow of a man you just killed and shared him with some friend of yours. Shared her some. What are you going to say to a jury?
That's strange.
I mean, what are you going to say? Now lay me down to sleep.
Yeah, but that's strange. I mean, I've been raping this woman, so you're such a good friend, I'm going to give you a piece. Is that...
You know, people think I'm crazy, but I've said this over and over again. There is something sexual about murder and violence. I think the reason, for example, our country's pretty violent. And I think a lot of it's because we're sexually repressed. We're too damn puritanical. We spend more time rubbing people and, you know, having orgasms. We wouldn't be killing so damn many people.
Well, you know, I remember when I was a burglar, that there's a certain amount of adrenaline rush.
Of course.
That you get while you're pulling a major heist. And that has erotic qualities.
And the same thing is true. I remember a murder case up in Livingston, Texas years ago. In fact, I mentioned it to you. There was a real, real nice family of African Americans, and their son joined the Navy and went down to Pensacola, Florida, and some gal down there fell in love with him. They thought she was a witch. I was fascinated because she's the only woman I've ever seen had hair on her chest. I'd never seen that before because she wore these low-cut dresses, and the woman had hair on her chest. Yeah. What happened, she follows him back from Florida to Livingston, and he rejects her again, and she shoots him in the head. He's laying in the bed dying. His best friend comes over, and they have sex on the floor beside the body. I mean, this is a little weird.
Well, this is in Tyler, Texas?
No, this is in Livingston, Texas.
Livingston, Texas.
Livingston, Texas.
That, what county is that?
Polk County.
Polk County.
Got up
and you were the defense lawyer in this case?
No, what happened? What happened? Apparently, this woman that did the killing had been sharing her hairy chest and sexual favors with the deputy sheriffs up there, and so apparently she was what you call horizontally available, for lack of a better word. And so the family, real sweet family, came up. In fact, the three pickup loads used to nag me, and they came up and said, "Look, we want this woman punished, and we don't think they're going to do it because she's been porking the sheriff's department." And they said, "We don't think the prosecutor up there, he was the one that did the Penry case, by the way, the prosecutor.
Oh, famous prosecutor. Uh-huh.
So we don't think he's going to do his job." And they asked me to be a special prosecutor. So I said, "Well, why not?" So I went up and was a special prosecutor on the lady with hair on the chest that had sex next to her dead boyfriend. So, you know.
Did you have any trouble with the jury?
No, I think what was funny about this, I've never tried many cases in little country towns. And it was mostly it was like a congregation. It was kind of like going to a state fair. There'd be potato salad going down one aisle and fried chicken down the other. And what would be so funny, during the trial, the witness would holler to people in the audience, "Hattie Mae, I didn't mean to do it." "Well, you did." And it was like a revival. And what was funny, I'll tell you the funny part about that whole case. The cops, there was, you know, a lot of those, as you well know, in East Texas, you have what we call the quarters.
What my relatives do in East Texas.
Yeah, I understand. But you know how they have that section they call the quarter?
Yeah.
Quarters? Well, the cops thought we were on their side, and they were going to raid the black clubs and the quarters, and we kept tipping the blacks off. And the next day, the cops would come and say, "We can't figure that out.
They got over there, wasn't nobody there."
They didn't know we were the snitches. We were snitching them off to all of our friends.
But you were the prosecutor.
Of course. They were... That's why the cops were talking to us. Plus, I'd cut my hair off, and they thought I was one of them.
Oh.
But they did. I tell you what, we got her put in jail, and I'll tell you what, there were no busts made for gambling or drinking or other stuff. We kept making sure of that. But anyway, in this case, Ray, this is one of those, truthfully, that the only realistic, fair argument for the death penalty, if you're going to have it, is that you have committed an unconscionable act. Because of that, you're going to pay for it with your life. It has nothing to do with deterrence. It's just that you committed an unconscionable act, and you've got to accept responsibility, and you're going to die for it. And that's exactly the theory behind in this particular case. Is one of those arguments you can make that argument in this case.
Well, that's some of these cases are not as pretty as others.
And I have told, and I have harped on this over and over again, with those who don't believe in the death penalty, what you generally never want to do is you always want to stay away from the facts. So some of these facts are so horrible. This set of facts is hard to make it any worse. Because here you got a guy that kills a bunch of people, has sex with a widow, then during the time he's in jail, he's raising hell, and then his family is hassling the victim's family during the trial. And you know, how could you make it any worse?
Mm-hmm. And so I think that what we've got here is Nancy Bailey on the... Nancy, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. A lot of traffic.
Well, where are you?
Well, we're on the corner of Maine and Benz. Maine and Benz.
Okay.
In front of the St. Paul's Methodist Church.
And there's a vigil there?
Yes. It's a smaller vigil today. We have four people here today.
And it's a little cooler out today than it was Tuesday.
Yeah.
You do this regularly, you go to these vigils.
Yes, I do, either here in Houston or up in Huntsville. Sometimes it's just a matter of time, and it's the one in Houston needs attention also. We have good traffic.
Yeah, we talked.
Yeah,
we talked to
good traffic.
We talked to Professor Longmire up in Huntsville. You know him because you've been up there, right? And so he's watching for us up there. Any comments you have to say about this case in particular, or about your work with the abolition movement?
Uh-huh.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
okay.
you because of the car. Could you say it again?
You're on the air now, and I ask you if you had any comments about this case or about your work with the abolition movement that you wanted to share with the audience.
Well, I think the case is about murder that took in San Antonio in a restaurant. Three Oriental people, Asian people, were murdered, and then a fourth one was apparently kidnapped and raped. That's essentially what the case was about.
And some of these cases are prettier than other cases, and this is not among them.
Yeah, this was not a
pretty
case.
But you're still there, so what's that about?
Well, what it is about is our issue doesn't have to do with whether a person is guilty or innocent or how bad the case was. We believe in all cases that the death penalty is not the proper punishment. Probably life without parole would be more suitable for even the worst of cases.
Well, this is a very rapid case. It's only 6 years old, and the man's being executed today, and that same thing has happened in Huntsville. They started moving the witnesses in before the top of the hour, and we just got a call from Huntsville, and we're going to put Professor Longmire on the phone after you. Apparently, the witnesses are crossing the street, and the whole process is over. Thank the folks there for us.
Certainly. It's nice talking to you, Ray.
And we'll see you next time around, and then we've got ten between now and Thanksgiving.
Yes, indeed. This was our 11th for this year, and there's 10 more. There's nothing scheduled as of now for December.
Thank you, ma'am.
Uh-huh. Bye.
Bye-bye. And so while Elizabeth gets Professor Longmire on the phone, he is in Huntsville. And that was Nancy Bailey, and she is here at the in Houston. There's a vigil that is held at St. Paul's Methodist Church property at the corner of Main Street and Vins, right across from the museums and all that. And St. Paul's provides that corner for this particular vigil. Normally, Dave Atwood would be there, and frequently there are some sisters from the Archdiocese office. And today, Nancy Bailey was there. Nancy is an activist in the abolition movement for some time. And Professor Longmire. Hello.
Hello.
Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, I gather that you got in touch with us, so that meant the witnesses have filed back across the street.
That's correct. The execution went forward. I could see one of the witnesses was crying, very visibly crying, and so the execution definitely went forward. They came out at approximately 6:20. They went in at 5:59, and so the state did not lose any time on this one.
Professor, you're actually an instructor at Sam Houston University.
That's correct.
What do you teach there?
I teach criminal justice.
And for a long time you have been coming to these vigils, is that right?
So I've been coming to the corner since 1984 when I first came to Texas, and standing in opposition to the death penalty since I got here.
And you came from?
I came down here from Ohio. I'm originally from Washington, D.C., did my graduate work at the University of Maryland.
Well, don't they execute people in Ohio and Maryland, too?
When I came down for the execution, when I came down to Huntsville, the state of Ohio had not been executing anyone. They have executed, and they've resumed executions, but it's not near as popular a sport there as it is down here.
I don't think it's popular sport anywhere as it is down here.
No, it's not. And I think that's fortunate, but it's also unfortunate that we happen to be caught up in this particular part of the country and part of the world where not only is execution so frequent, but there seems to be so little concern about it. As I mentioned at one time earlier, there are no members of the media covering this execution on the corner outside, at least. Of course, the regular media went in to witness, and they have probably already written their stories, and they're probably filing them online as we speak. But the execution is not the story. The story will be the victimization and the crime. And, of course, the crime was a horrible crime, and the victims do warrant our sympathy and attention. But so, too, do the families of the man that we just murdered. And the crime that we have committed, I think, is more serious than the crime that he committed, because we did it with such deliberation and such a lack of real sensitivity or concern.
Well, Professor, in this case, I mean, we're just talking about 6 years from the commission of the crime until the execution of the culprit. And that's almost a record short period of time.
It certainly is fast. I mean, I think overall the average is like 7 years, but that includes in that arithmetic mean some people who have taken 12 and 13 years. And so the fact that this one proceeded so quickly suggests that we are definitely moving a lot faster in this process than we have before.
Well, I put it to the attorney, Jim Skelton, who is in the studio with me tonight. Was it this case, or are we going to be seeing more of this? And he felt it was more or less this case. And your opinion is different.
Yeah, of course, I'm not a lawyer, and so he might have some insight into some of the legal maneuverings that did not happen in this case that maybe...
Jim, you're welcome to step in.
What happened in others?
They didn't waste any paper on this guy, was Jim's line.
Exactly. There didn't seem to be very much that could be used. I mean, and I only read the media descriptions of the crime, and this guy did not do himself any favors. He was seriously dislocated by everybody who's ever had much involvement with him in terms of the legal system. And so... I'm not sure what his overall plan was, but it seems like it worked out against him.
Professor, let me tell you the problem from a lawyer's viewpoint. The problem is you had a guy that was captured almost immediately with the murder weapon, with the victim he just raped, and he gave a confession. So guilt or innocence, there's not a whole lot to argue about.
Exactly.
And then
not much evidence that could be challenged and things of that sort. So it was...
And let me tell you the other big problem.
If you will.
You know when you're... Okay, go ahead. The other problem is, you know, when you have a case like this, the only issue is punishment. So you want to do what you can then to minimize the damage. Let me tell you what this guy did.
Yeah.
During the time he was in the Bexar County Jail, he was constantly in fights, constantly in trouble. He wrote letters knowing the jail people would read it, talking about joining a black activist group called the Black Guerrillas, wanting to join that, wrote letters about wanting to kill Hispanics and white people. And
exactly.
All that came in front of the jury.
Like I said, I don't know what his plan was, but...
Well, it's planned to kill himself.
Well, normally, I have a theory that we don't kill the person who did the crime because of the passage of time is that by the time we get around to executing them, they're a significantly different kind of person. They're not strung out on drugs anymore. They're not in this kind of pitch battle against the world attitude that they may have had when they committed the crime. So they commit the crime, and it's a horrible, nasty, ugly, terrible thing to read about. But 10 or 15 years later, we execute a different person. But in this case... we may not have had time for him to reform.
Yeah.
And Professor,
I was talking to someone on the corner who's showing me his tattoos. In this particular case, it is very complicated because, as you say, he almost is the same person from what we can gather. I don't know very much about his history while he was on death row. I don't know whether he was involved in very much difficulty. I heard people talking about him when we were out here 2 days ago, they were saying that he had promised that he was not going to go peacefully, and I don't know whether or not he lived up to that promise. I don't know if he had to be extracted.
You know, we don't ever know that.
No, and they in fact, we were told that the Polunsky unit has been locked down in part because of his particular threats and his claim that he was going to make it difficult. I don't know if there's any truth to that or not, but that's what I was told.
Well, we've got a busy few weeks ahead of us, Professor Longmire, and I suspect we'll be talking to you later.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for what you do, and keep up the good work.
And give our regards to the folks that are there for their vigilance and care.
I will do that. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And that was Professor Longmire. And, Jim, you have anything you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I'm going to mention several things, and it always has bothered me because I've been inside the system. I was a prosecutor, and I was also a defense lawyer for years and years, and I taught at law school, so I've seen kind of both sides of this. And the things that bother me is I don't think that people who are advocates against the death penalty really have hit the nail on the head yet. In fact, the only really good, and I think they lost a lot of credibility, and a lot of what the fast track is our own fault, because we have tolerated insane writ writers who've delayed the system. We've got stuff like this new legislation they put through under Clinton, the Federal Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. It was done simply because we overloaded the courts with frivolous writs. And let me make a suggestion to you. Probably the best, most logical, credible argument I've ever heard against the death penalty was from Scott Turow. Scott Turow was that former U.S. attorney that's been a writer and a novelist. And he was head, in fact, he was appointed by the governor of Illinois to head that commission. If you recall, the governor of Illinois a number of years ago granted a moratorium mm-hmm. on death penalty
sure,
cases.
Sure.
But he was head of the commission.
Mm-hmm.
And Turow, when he started it, was for the death penalty. He's a former prosecutor. In fact, he took a poll among those on the commission.
Yeah, I've met him. He and I appeared with Reuben Carter at Santa Barbara, and I met him and carried on some conversation with a very interesting fellow.
And here's what he said. He wrote an op-ed page for the New York Times, and he said a very logical thing. He said at the end of his work on that commission, he was against the death penalty. And here's what he said. It's not that people have not committed acts that they don't deserve to die for. I mean, this a guy like this, it's hard to make any argument that he didn't deserve to die. He said, our problem is, as a society, we just can't do it right. For example, men are more likely to be executed than women for the mm-hmm. same crimes. In rural areas, you're more likely to be executed than in urban areas. Mm-hmm. And he talks about it. We just haven't got the ability as people to have a system that's fair and right that we can feel safe about. That's why he's against the death penalty. Not because people don't deserve to die.
Yeah, well, I've said for years the question is not that people don't deserve killing. I keep a list of people that I think deserve killing next to my computer. They're usually high government officials.
How many on it, Larry?
About 22, and at present, and it grows and shrinks depending upon the ebb and flow of news.
On the moon, as far as the moon?
No, ebb and flow of news from capital cities and things of that nature, city halls, etc. But what bothers me is that I suspect my name is on similar lists
somebody
next
else's
to
bedside.
Others' computers, and the question is, who gets executed first? We're going to be joined now someone who has spent a good bit of time studying this issue from a lot of things. This is from, I believe, is it Leslie Little? Leslie?
Lytle.
Lytle. Leslie Lytle. And tell us, Leslie, about your book, number one.
Okay, well, I just recently have my book, Execution Step, Two Stories of the Innocent and Near Damned, was recently released by the University Press of New England in conjunction with the Criminal Justice Studies program at Northeastern University. And it's the story of five innocent individuals who were sentenced to death and then later were released from death row, either because the state dropped charges, they were acquitted at retrial, or they were received a gubernatorial pardon. I spent 4 years researching it, and it's the stories are very much from the point of view of both the individual who's sentenced to death and then the point of view of law enforcement officials, the attorneys, so it goes back and forth. So you get a full picture of what was going on.
Well, you know, of course, the play and movie, Exonerated, is making the rounds, and that includes, I guess, seven cases. Since we've changed district attorneys in Dallas, there have been 21 or so exonerations from, not all of them execution exonerations, but serious crime exonerations from Dallas courts because of often prosecutorial misconduct, police misconduct, and certainly the not accurately handling the evidence. So this is a big problem.
Yes.
In criminal law.
Yes, it is. And in fact, the two primary causes of wrongful convictions, wrongful capital convictions in any case, are Brady violations, that is, withholding of evidence by the prosecution, and defense attorneys who did not present an adequate defense on behalf of the accused.
Well, how long have you been looking into these things?
Actually, I started the book in November of 2004, so it's been essentially a four-year project.
Now, that doesn't seem to be much question about guilt or innocence in this case, or do you have a different point of view?
In terms of the Kevin Watts
yes.
case? No, well, certainly there's not a guilt or innocence issue here. I mean, he confessed. And at this point, too, I would like to say I express my sympathy to the Kim family and the Banks family and the Shook family and to Mr. Kim's widow as well, because it was a terrible tragedy. But I also want to say that I send my sympathy to the Watts family, because in the course of this process, we have just created another murder victim family. And Mr. Watts had an 8-year-old daughter, and now she is an orphan.
Now, Mr. Watts, this was a very rapid execution.
Yes.
I mean, it was only 6 years ago they had the crime, and already they've done the executing. That's rare in the execution business, isn't it?
Yes, that's very quick, and it does vary from state to state. The men that were in my book were on death row from 3 to 17 years before their innocence was verified and they were released. So that is certainly quick for an execution, and I think, as I said, it varies in terms of how long before the execution takes place. I remember in one case in particular, one of my subjects, Michael Graham, was on death row for 14 years and in Angola and Louisiana, and there the average was, I think, 9.5 years, and he passed that mark, but his case had remained on that entire time on direct appeal, which was certainly very unusual.
Well, even on Texas' busy death row, some people languish there for years, 20 years in some cases, but there are issues.
I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
If there are issues that continue to come up and require reexamination, a case can remain there for decades.
Well, yes, that's true. And I actually, you know, I think Mr. Skelton seemed to think that there were no issues in the Watts case, although I did spend some time today looking over the various things that had been written about it. And again, what I found in my work was that a very high percentage of the wrongful convictions were linked to either economic poverty issues or racial and ethnic bias issues. And that's very typical in terms of Texas's execution.
Yeah, when I listened to the story, as Jim explained and as I was reading them earlier, the story, I kept wondering, how could a sane person do all of this? What about the issue of insanity?
Pardon?
What about the issue of insanity?
The issue of what?
Insanity.
Well, that's a very good question, because as a matter of fact, the one thing that did come up at the appeal, in one of the later appeals, was that at the punishment portion, sentencing portion of the trial, the only mitigating witness he had was a social worker that was not, had never testified before at a capital trial and was not certified to serve as a mitigating witness, and the judge would not let her present the evidence that she had prepared, which, among other things, included the fact that Kevin Watts was sexually molested as a child and that he began using serious drugs in elementary school. And the night of the crime, he had taken marijuana, alcohol, Xanax, ecstasy, and I think something else. I'd have to look. But, I mean, that cocktail of drugs, it's wonder it didn't kill him that very night.
I read that.
Cocaine.
I read that report, and he just seemed to be a vacuum cleaner for every available drug that was around.
Yeah, right. I mean, who could possibly be in any kind of state of mind where they could think straight at all? I mean, in terms of what he did was utterly bizarre. And one thing he said to the police, I mean, he went in there to rob the restaurant. He didn't go in there to kill anyone. He went because he wanted fast cash. He had his girlfriend and his daughter, and he wanted to get some money. He got $100. And the victims started yelling at him, and he just, you know, he lost control, which is not surprising given his state of mind at the time. Nothing that he did certainly was rational.
Well, do you really think that a rural Texas court would give that much mitigation?
Do I think that they would or they should?
Would. I mean, let's incorporate the culture here, too.
Right. Well,
this was Bexar County. This was
Bexar County.
Bexar County.
Right.
This is not a rural county. This is an urban city.
Right. This was in San Antonio, wasn't it?
It was in San Antonio.
Yes. Yeah. Right. But it's not so much a matter of the county. It's simply a matter of the fact that there's a vast disparity in the money available to the prosecution, to the state, and what is available to defense attorneys for indigent clients who don't hire private attorneys. I know one of the men in my book, most of them, actually, were defended by public defenders. And one of them, their public defender, received $1,000. He was hired by the Indigent mm-hmm. Defenders Bureau. And he received $1,000 a month, regardless of how many cases he tried, regardless of whether they were DUIs or homicides. Needless to say, he could not spend a whole lot of time on this case. The few public defenders that do actually devote themselves seriously to creating a proper defense for the client usually work for less than minimum wage.
What about that Georgia case in the Supreme Court of the United States, where your basic evidence is not tangible evidence at all, but the Troy Davis case. It seems to be a lot easier to take a witness's word when they're testifying against somebody than it is to take their word when they're recanting their testimony.
Well, again, you're exactly right there. And, in fact, the courts very much frown on recanted testimony. That's one of the big problems, is that it's much easier to convict someone, even if the evidence is fabricated and false and the result of coercion of witnesses or jailhouse snitches that results in the conviction, than it is to undo that, because the view of the courts tends to be that if they lied the first time, what is the reason to believe them the second time around? And that happened actually in several of the cases that I worked on.
And the business of using jailhouse and other snitches, where somebody has a vested interest in testifying one way as opposed to another, that's also a frequent issue.
That's also a frequent problem. And I really wonder how that continues to be even legal, why the courts continue to allow that, because it seems so obvious that when this person is getting some sort of favors, which they always do for their testimony, why that would be regarded as a valid in the original trial, yet when someone who was not in the prison system testifies falsely, often because they were coerced or because they were scared or they had someone that they wanted to protect, then when they come around and try to tell the truth, the courts will not listen to it.
Where are you, Ms. Lionel?
Pardon?
Where are you sitting?
I am in Tennessee.
Tennessee. From where you are, do you see any lessening of enthusiasm for executions?
Well, unfortunately, to back up, Tennessee had no executions from 1960 until 2000, and we've had three since then, and two relatively recently. But last year we did get a study bill passed examining the state's death penalty. There's many problems. There are far more African Americans on death row, proportionate to the society as a whole, just like in Texas. And in terms of a vast percentage of the African Americans had all white juries. That's something else that I found to be the case. People of color often were tried by all white juries or with a token person of color on the jury. But the good thing that we've got going now is the death penalty study is bringing attention to some of the issues like the racial and economic disparity. No one on Tennessee's death row had a private attorney. And if my statistics are accurate on this, and I've read this somewhere else, and to the best of my ability to find out if they are, no one since the mid-70s when the death penalty was reinstated who was defended at the original trial by a private attorney has ever been executed. That tells you that it's something that's vastly wrong with the system.
Professor Lytle, we appreciate your work in Tennessee. Again, the name of your book is Executions Doorstep, True Stories of the Innocent and Near Damned. And that is by Northeastern University Press, and I suppose it's available in bookstores?
Yes, and on any of your regular online outlets.
And your website is www.executionsdoorstep.com. That's executions, plural, executions doorstep.
Right, even though in the title it's an apostrophe because the apostrophe would not work.
It doesn't work on the email.
Webpage.
Thank you very much, and have a good evening.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, Jim, that's... that's that cycle. Our work's done here except for a couple of old men sitting around talking about what happened today.
I'm going to make some comments about this. You know, in this case, if you had $10 million, it wouldn't have done you any good. I mean, there's not much you could have done with a case like this.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to take up for them, but courts slowly, and we're kind of slow to do things, our courts have been slowly recognizing the fact that more money, for example, we had a case a number of years, it was about 3 years ago, they reversed a case on a lady accused of killing her own baby because, and this was a hired lawyer that took her in on a plea, and what they said, and Kathy Cochran wrote the opinion, because they needed a lot of money, and this woman was too poor. In fact, she hired a lawyer, didn't have enough money to hire experts, so the lawyer took all the money.
Sure.
So they needed a bunch of experts to prove cause of death, and he never petitioned the court. And our court came down real hard, and they laid out a groundwork that said that even though a person has a private practitioner, they're going to start making funds available, substantial amount of funds, to hire experts. As a matter of fact, Mike Snyder, about this past year, they hired on a case he approved here in Harris County, on a case involving a kid in drugs that was tried with the murder case, they approved of getting the best professor from Harvard, flew him down here, and the county spent around $600,000 to provide expert testimony for an indigent defendant. Now, I'm not saying this has not happened in times past, but courts now are kind of waking up, and the problem isn't so much, especially in death penalty cases, because generally, at least in most instances, they don't try unless guilt is pretty well assured, and the only thing got left is punishment. What they're doing now, they're providing much more money for lawyers to hire experts. experts. It's not so much the lawyers, it's having lawyers having the money to hire an expert to come in and testify as expert testimony and mitigation. And sometimes all that money doesn't help. I'll give you two examples. This past week, we had Mike Ramsey's law firm defended a guy for murder. He gets 99 years, and they didn't do it at Walmart prices. He was a hired lawyer. He got a ton of money for doing it, and he gets a 99-year verdict. By the same token, Mike DeGuerin defended a gal out of Clear Lake on a killing down there. Hired lawyer, paid a bunch of money. She gets an automatic life sentence. And there's some, and they hired a bunch of experts coming in, told me she was a heroin addict. Didn't do a nickel's worth of good. So our courts are slow. I think it's kind of passe, at least in Texas and metropolitan areas. In fact, smaller counties now are refusing to do a lot of death penalty cases. They want to go to the expense of hiring experts. But our courts, at least here in Texas, in the last about 5 years, have really, really been strong providing the funds that somebody needs to represent somebody. And that day of the old sleeping lawyer like Joe Cannon, the guy that had the bad wig.
Yeah, well,
wig,
Joe Cannon, but at the same time, Joe Cannon was going around getting paid for whatever.
Of course.
His rest needed in the courtroom. At the same time that was happening, you're running around with Will Gray, who to me is one of the great heroes of justice in Texas, because
right.
Will basically bankrupted himself representing capital punishment.
Wine helped a little bit.
Well, wine might have.
Yeah, and wine kind of contributed. He's a major contributing factor.
Well, he liked better wine than I did.
I did. Well, you know, my idea of wine, there's two types, corked and with lids and corks. Now I always understand the lids better than the corks. But, no, our courts, and they're not appointing these guys like Joe. Joe Cannon was pathetic. This was back in the old, kind of the dark ages. Nowadays, the people that do death penalty cases, they have to be certified by the state, have to have a certain minimum amount of training. And the problem is, in most of these death penalty cases, they're so, like, for example, if you had $10 million and they brought you the facts of this case that we're talking about tonight, what the hell would you have done?
That's right.
I mean, maybe you can spend $10 million to break him out of jail. That's all you could do. I mean, short of that, there's no money would never solve this problem. Because here's the problem with the insanity part. Number one, you can be crazy as a bedbug and be legally sane. Because the test for sanity is whether or not you knew what you did was wrong when you did it. Well, in the way they always look at, did you run away from the crime after you committed the murder? Well, yeah, he ran away with a widow. So he obviously knew what he did was wrong. So insanity's out the window. As far as the drug usage, and then we can argue this day and night, I'm never much of a believer that drugs cause people to do things. Drugs don't feel, people feel. And I don't, and I, this idea that drugs cause me to do it, mm-hmm. The way the law looks at drugs is real simple. If you voluntarily get intoxicated, you voluntarily take drugs, that is not a defense, even if you voluntarily take it to the point that you're temporarily insane. Because the idea is, by God, you took them and you're responsible for them. Now, it may be used as a mitigating factor. But you take your average, typical, everyday Joe Blow on a jury. When a guy comes, well, I got drunk and did it when I was drunk. They don't care.
I got drunk and I didn't do
yeah,
it.
Well, I got drunk and I didn't do what you did. I got drunk and made love. You moron, you kill people, you know. And it's just not going to work. It's just not going to work. And see, that one of the frustrations that lawyers have is the people that talk about this stuff, they've never tried these cases. I'm going to give you a real good example. And this just annoys me. People have been running around squawking here about how horrible the law of parties is. Terrible things should be abolished. You realize Charlie Manson, if we didn't have a law of parties, would never have been
never
convicted.
Never be in prison. He didn't do anything.
He didn't do anything. He was not present at the murder scene. Didn't do any killing. But yet, if you want us to abolish the law of parties, you better free Charlie Manson.
Well, Charlie keeps telling us that every time he comes up for parole. I don't know what I'm doing here.
And you have these nuts that run around that say this crazy stuff. All the law of parties basically says is real simple. If you and I plan something, and I encourage you to do something wrong, and any person in my shoes could logically figure you'd kill somebody, then by damn I'm responsible as you are. Oh, I didn't pull the trigger. That to me seems logical. If I put you out, Charlie Manson, he didn't do any killings, didn't go into Sharon Tate's house, and wasn't even there.
Yeah.
But he gets convicted for that murder. Why? Because he set it up, encouraged it, and did it. And he should have been held responsible for it. He was convicted on the law of parties. When you hear these people squawking about the law of parties being bad, fine, let's free Manson and see how well they would like it.
Yeah. I don't know. This is you're listening to radio station KPFT on the internet because we don't have a broadcast unit so that we can send this out on the HD2 channel. This is an extension of KPFT's The Prison Show. So we got around one evening discussing that when somebody is executed in Texas, there's almost a silence about it. You hear KPFT News at 5 o'clock mention that it's going to happen, and you might hear my voice or some other friendly voice on telling you some of the information, but to go into details, I know a lot more about Kevin Watts now than I did 3 days ago, and I suspect some of you did. And the opinions we exchange here are, in fact, our opinions. I have every reason to believe Jim Skelton's going to walk in here and be real honest about what he thinks about things, and as I am. You're welcome to have different opinions, and sooner or later we'll figure out a mechanism where you can express your different opinions, because we think your opinions are as valid, certainly to you, as ours are to us. We wouldn't be able to do this if we didn't have the electronic magic of Otis McClay. Otis McClay is himself a fine broadcaster, and he is our engineer that makes all this happen when it happens. But in addition to that, he's also a fine dramatist and a writer. And he's also a loyal follower of the principles of Pacifica Foundation, which, as are we all.
And he designs a mean website. Executionwatch.org.
That actually works. And our website is executionwatch.org. And if you've missed any of our previous programs, they are archived there. You can listen to any program that we have done. We missed one during the storm because we didn't have electricity here to make it happen. And who was that, Jim? What was that fellow's name?
I think his name is Hanton. See, I got it written somewhere.
September 17th.
He was the guy that killed and raped the 93-year-old woman.
It was on September 17th. But since we began doing this program, we have covered every execution since. And we're going to be busy because there are 10 more executions scheduled between now and Thanksgiving. Then they take a holiday and they stop executing people.
Alvin Kelly is the name of the
Alvin
guy. Otis just whispered
Thank
in my
you,
ear.
Otis.
I think he whispered in my ear. It felt pretty good. Hey, Otis.
Yeah, check the website. All that information is there. But the fact of the matter is that Texas is in an executing mood, but they're going to take Christmas off. Elizabeth Stein, you ought to put that essay on the website. Wrote a very fine essay about why is it that we stop executing people to celebrate the birth date of the most famous capital punishment executee in history. And so that's an interesting thing for you to mull about. This is radio station KPFT Houston. The radio station is in fund drive. And if you would like to see us continue this work and the radio station continue its fine work, you can go to the telephone. You call 713-526-5738. Or you can go to kpft.org and do it magically on the internet, which has seemed to be the vogue. You've been listening to Texas Execution Watch, KPFT Houston.
And we'll be back Tuesday.
And we'll be back next Tuesday, Elizabeth tells me. Elizabeth Stein is our producer. And we'll be back next Tuesday. And until then, I'm Ray Hill, and I'll see you next week.